It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. A million miles away from Earth, the James Webb Space Telescope is taking images of the universe, showing us what it looked like over 13 billion years ago, close to the Big Bang and the beginning of time itself. The latest images from the telescope are closer to home with a look at Jupiter, the biggest planet in our solar system. We're taking a look now at what we've learned from the James Webb Telescope, Jupiter and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the saga of the James Webb Telescope? How about the images that have been coming out lately? Do you have a favorite? Do you have one you want to ask about? Call it at 800-642-1234. If you're a backyard astronomer, love to hear from you and what you've been looking at lately. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. Thomas Beattie is an assistant professor of astronomy at UW-Madison. He helped build the camera on the James Webb Telescope that took those photos of Jupiter we're going to talk about. Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
And I should also say welcome to Wisconsin. You're brand new on the faculty at UW-Madison, I believe.
That's right. We just moved up here this month, so it's nice to be back up with trees instead of cactuses.
Well, we've got this welcome for you with these new images of Jupiter. What was your reaction to seeing these photos of the big planet using a camera you helped make?
It's super exciting. I think, you know, we have spent the last 7 months since JWST, the Webb, launched, checking out the instrument and making sure it worked. And now we're finally getting these amazing images from it of Jupiter and everything else in the sky. So it's very exciting to see this and see that it's performing as well as we could have hoped.
Before we dig more into Jupiter, I want to talk about the capabilities of this telescope. It seems like it's a game changer for astronomy. What is it that makes it so different than even, you know, the Hubble?
So the big difference for any telescope, the thing that matters is how big is the mirror? How much light can it collect? And the big difference between James Webb and Hubble is that James Webb has a mirror that is 10 times larger. And we also observe at different wavelengths. So this is giving us, you know, a 10 times roughly better view of what's out there in the universe.
I've heard the argument that in the future, we're going to talk about astronomy before the Webb telescope and after. I mean, is it that stark a difference, do you think?
Well, you know, it's always hard to predict the future in science, but if I had to guess, I think that's exactly right. I think in 5 years, I think the textbooks are going to be completely different. I think that Webb is going to just blow everything out of the water compared to what we know now. So it's a very exciting time to be doing astronomy.
All right, let's steer us back toward Jupiter now, but not too close. It's big. What kind of things are we seeing in these images? What kind of things are we hoping to learn about Jupiter?
So in these images, what you can see is, so first off, you see the beautiful cloud bands on Jupiter. We've seen before from spacecraft and from the ground and from Hubble, but we're really seeing them in a way that we've never seen before. We're observing at different wavelengths of light, so sort of different colors, which lets us see different parts of the atmosphere. And so we can see these bands of clouds. We can see the vortices in the clouds. That tells us about what the clouds are made out of, how the weather on Jupiter works. Which we don't understand very well. We also can see the auroras on the top and the bottom. That tells us about Jupiter's magnetic field. Ultimately, all of this is telling us about what is happening inside Jupiter. What is it made out of? How does its atmosphere work? And really what we want to try and get at is how was Jupiter formed? Because that really tells us about how planets are formed in the solar system and everywhere in the universe.
Yeah, it's a gas giant because it's big, gas because it's mostly gas. What is it that led to the formation of a gas giant, say, instead of a planet like a rocky planet like Earth or a star?
So that's a very good question, Rob, and something that a lot of people in here at UW are working on right now. When planets form, sometimes they form into planets like Earth. Sometimes they form into planets like Jupiter. The dividing line there is actually not well understood. There's actually a term. It's called runaway accretion, where if you get big enough, you can accrete gas. You can gather gas and form into a giant planet. And why some planets do that and why some planets don't is not something that's well understood at the moment. So it's something we're hoping to learn from images like these.
We are talking about the newest images from the James Webb Space Telescope. Thomas Beattie is with us from the Astronomy Department at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions, what you've thought of the images so far. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Luke is with us in Duluth. Luke, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Beautiful images coming from the telescope. So I've seen some articles saying that some of the discoveries from the web could call into question the Big Bang itself. I'm just wondering if there's any merit to that or to kind of expound on what that might be talking to. I don't know any of the evidence myself, so thank you.
Luke, thanks for the call. I've seen those notions going around there, and I've seen articles debunking the notion that it's debunking the Big Bang. Thomas, what does this tell us about the earliest days of the universe?
Well, so Webb is going to be really give us an exquisite view into the earliest days of the universe. Luke, to your question about whether or not it's going to debunk the Big Bang, I will say the Big Bang at this point, I think, is pretty settled. The Webb is not going to debunk the Big Bang. What it will do, though, is really allow us to push really close to that event and see for the first time some of the first stars and some of the first galaxies forming in the process of coming together, which is going to give us a much better idea of some of the timescales that are happening very early on in the universe's life and some of the mechanics of how the Big Bang occurred. But Webb is not going to disprove the Big Bang, but it will give us a much better understanding of what happened at very early times in the universe.
Luke, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Thomas, that reminds me of one of the mind-blowing things about looking deep into space that I sort of get and yet don't get. The further the distance the stars or galaxies we're looking at, the further back in time we're looking at. Do I have that about right?
That's right. It's a great game to play. It's we get to just sit here and watch the whole universe evolve around us. It happens because light travels. Light has a speed. It's 186,000 miles per second, which seems incredibly fast. But on the scales of outer space, that's relatively slow. It takes light 8 minutes to get to us from the sun. It would take several hours to cross the solar system. So when you look at these galaxies that are a billion light years away, that means that the light has been traveling to us for a billion years. So we are seeing them, the light that was emitted a billion years ago. So as you look further away, the light has required longer to get to us. And so that's why we can see, I'm doing air quotes, further back into the history of the universe. So it's an amazing trick that allows us to see the universe evolve around us without us having to really move anywhere or do anything. We just need to look up and see what the universe is telling us.
We're talking about the latest James Webb images. It was one of the scientists who helped build one of the telescope's cameras, the infrared one, Thomas Beattie, who's an assistant professor of astronomy at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how we see into space, what we're learning from this new telescope, or a question about what we could learn from it? Have you been following the images? Have any struck you in particular that you maybe want to know more about? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Thomas Beattie, an assistant professor of astronomy at UW-Madison. He helped build the infrared camera on the James Webb Telescope. We're talking about the images that camera has taken so far, what the images teach us about the universe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I love Central Time. I had a question. I'm wondering, what's next after James Webb? I know I'm getting a little far in the future, but is there any ideas of maybe another telescope, something more advanced, something maybe with a bigger mirror? That's my question. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Jack, thanks. There's a long road to get to the Webb telescope. Thomas, what could be next?
That's a very good question, Jack. That's something that everybody in astronomy is thinking a lot about right now. So there is one mission that's going to come up large mission. So usually things are divided up into sort of 10-year time spans for astronomy. The next one is going to be a mission called the Roman Space Telescope, which is going to look at really deep into the universe and really probe what's going on in other galaxies and how galaxies form. And after that, there's very general plans for sort of the next generation of Hubble and Webb, something that, you know, could be a 6 or 8 or 16 meter diameter mirror. Hubble is 2.4 meters and Webb is 6 meters. So something even wow. larger than Webb, which would be very exciting, but that probably won't happen at least for another 15 or 20 years. These have pretty long lead times on these missions.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Thomas, I understand a lot of your research is looking for exoplanets. So planets like we have in our solar system, but in other solar systems. Do you have hopes that the Webb can help find some of those?
Yeah, it's funny. Looking at these Jupiter images, it's a much more closer to home version of what I work on day to day. So Webb, usually we're not going to be using it to, what we're going to be using it to is look at planets that we know are there, and we're going to look at their atmospheres. And so we're going to try and figure out, what are these planets made out of? You know, usually when we find a planet, we know how big it is, how heavy it is, but we have no idea if it's got an atmosphere, if it's like the Earth, for instance, or if it's like Venus, which are very similar in our solar system. But Venus, if you land on it, your spacecraft melts 5 minutes later. But Earth is a nice place to visit. And so we're going to be looking at those. We're going to be looking at giant planets, and we're going to be trying to figure out what planets might be like the Earth, and we're going to be trying to better understand how planets are formed in general.
And did I see you wrote a thing on trying to detect something like Earth? Like if somebody else is looking for Earth, they might be able to find something interesting about us by looking at our night side and all the lights we've got. How would we look for that on other planets?
I did write something on that, Rob. So that actually goes back to that caller's question about the next generation space telescope. So some of the plans for the bigger next gen space telescope with the larger mirrors would be able to see night lights or city lights on the night sides of some of these planets. So we know that there are some potentially habitable planets, planets that are about the same size as the Earth at about the right distance from their stars, around nearby stars. And so with these next gen telescopes, we could look at the night sides, and if they're using city lights like we see here on Earth, we could possibly detect that emission. They'd have to have a lot more cities than on Earth, probably 10 times as much as we have on Earth right now. But that would be one way to, we call it a technosignature, one way to technologically determine that there's life elsewhere in the universe.
Now, NASA, we've been talking about images. NASA dropped an audio clip, apparently the sound of a black hole region. Now, this is, we're going to give a listen to what they released. This is bumped up 50-some octaves. The actual sound would be way too low for humans to hear. Here's a little taste of what they released. Should probably have had a content warning on this. It's kind of disturbing. Now, I always thought, Thomas, there's no sound in space. Sound doesn't travel, but NASA says no, it can. Why?
Well, you're right, Rob. They had to do some modification on this. So what we're listening to, what we were just listening to there, is in every galaxy that we see, there is a black hole in the center of it, including in our own galaxy, in the Milky Way. There's a big, giant black hole in the center of all the galaxies. And around that is all this gas that's falling into it. And on Earth, when we hear sound, what that is that's the air vibrating around us. So that's the reason why there's no sound in space, because there's no air in space. But if you have a black hole that has all this gas falling into it, what we're listening to is that gas does vibrate. There are pressure waves, exactly like sound in the air, passing through it. The big difference is that the sound that we just heard is, had to be stepped up in frequency by a factor of about 100 billion, I believe, to be able to be heard, right? It wouldn't be something we could hear. It's super low frequency. But if you step it up, then you get that super eerie sound that we were just listening to. That sort of is the sound of what a black hole makes.
On a practical level, if I'm an astronomer, I'm not, but if I was, and I wanted to get some time with the Webb to point it in the directions that I wanted to, what goes into that? How do you make that kind of reservation?
Well, you know, Rob, you and I could write a proposal. So, I mean, the way it works is you write, anybody in the U.S. Can write a proposal, including you, Rob, or any of the listeners could write a proposal to NASA and submit it. And you just, you know, you get 3 to 6 pages of text to argue for why you think you should be allowed to get some amount of time, you know, 10 hours of James Webb time to point it where you want. And then it's actually relatively democratic. Those proposals go in and then they get a bunch of other astronomers, usually people who have not written proposals for James Webb, to then review all of them and decide what gets selected and what isn't. And I've served on a bunch of those panels, like for the Hubble Space Telescope, where we review other people's proposals. And usually it's a pretty good discussion. So it's a pretty democratic system that usually ends up being pretty fair, but you know, there's always some outliers, but that's generally how it works. And it's a lot of work around proposal time, but you get good science out of it. So it's all worth it.
And just our last half a minute or so, what are you excited to learn next from the Webb telescope?
Well, like I said, I work on exoplanets. I think our understanding of exoplanets, planets outside the solar system, what makes a habitable planet, how planets are formed, is going to be completely different 5 years from now than it is today. And we're just starting that journey literally like today. So it's a very exciting time to be a part of this field.
Thomas, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Thomas Beatty, assistant professor of astronomy at UW-Madison. He helped build one of the cameras on the James Webb telescope. He talked to us about the pictures the telescope has taken so far, including those images of Jupiter and more. More than a century ago, nearly 200 Ojibwe graves were removed from the burial grounds on a strip of land offshore from Lake Superior. Now, Danielle Kading reports that members of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa are celebrating the return of those burial lands to the tribe.
Lake Superior is calm as it laps against the shoreline at Wisconsin Point one sunny August afternoon. Every year for nearly 2 decades, descendants of Chief Joseph Osagi gather here to reunite. Some are meeting relatives for the first time. 99-year-old Osagi descendant Colleen Aird says being here this year is a real thrill because this year marks the first gathering since the Superior City Council approved transferring a small lot to the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. The site marks the tribe's burial grounds.
This is really home. Our roots are here.
Yeah, we have more family here.
Hey, how's it going?
At the gathering, a group of around 50 people share stories around a fire. Aird says her father told her about what life was like then in the one-room schoolhouse on Wisconsin Point.
They had a pot-bellied stove when it was cold, and he would have to build the fire in there to warm up the schoolroom. And then he'd have to row the boat over to Superior, and the teacher was waiting there.
The tribe settled on the sandbar stretching nearly 3 miles along Lake Superior as early as 400 years ago. By the mid-19th century, Chief Joseph Osagi was leading a small but thriving community there. In 1852, Osagi and other Ojibwe leaders traveled to Washington, D.C. to fight a presidential order forcing them from their lands. The trip resulted in the 1854 treaty that set up reservations in northern Wisconsin and Minnesota. Despite that treaty, says 66-year-old Osagi descendant and Superior native Lori Madden, in 1918, the community and the remains of her ancestors were wrongfully removed.
They took 198 graves and they moved them by scow down the Nemadji River to St. Francis Cemetery, where then they put them into the graves there.
The remains were reburied elsewhere to make way for U.S. Steel's plans to put up ore docks at the Superior port. Those docks were never built, and the removal was paid for with federal funds intended to benefit tribal members. More than a year ago, Superior City Council President Jenny Van Sickle launched an effort to return burial sites to the tribe. The council approved a resolution to transfer the lands in July last year. For Osagi families, the stories passed down about Wisconsin Point are treasured memories. Madden says the history of this place was lost to her and others.
My mom and dad did not share stories with us because of the fact of discrimination.
She and others recounted how fear of discrimination prompted their parents to keep quiet about their native heritage. Aird says her mother went to an Indian boarding school in Bayfield. Such schools focused on eliminating tribal lifeways and barred children from speaking their own language. Now, Aird's daughter, Pat Nelson, says her daughter, Veronica, has been learning about the culture and studying the Ojibwe language.
She's kind of bringing us back to those traditions.
About 2 weeks after the reunion, the Fond du Lac tribe hosted a celebration to mark the return of those lands, including a drum ceremony. Aird attended the celebration just days after her 99th birthday.
I never thought this day would ever come.
Ben Sickle, an Alaskan native, says it's important to humanize places that can get lost in textbooks.
They're real people with stories. You know, native perspective, native voices are not optional, and there's a lot of work ahead.
Fond du Lac tribal chairman Kevin Dupuy looked on as Superior Mayor Jim Payne signed over lands to the tribe. Now, Dupuy says the work ahead may include a monument to replace pillars that currently mark the site. He searched for words to capture the feeling of the moment.
I just want to go in the woods. I think I should be at Wisconsin Point right now, or St. Francis Cemetery, telling them what we did.
Now, Dupuy says their people can finally be left to rest. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now the first Pay What You Can museum restaurant in Wisconsin, maybe the nation, just opened at the Madison Children's Museum. The restaurant is called Little John's Lunchbox. It's open to museum guests and anyone in the community. Jonathan Zarov is Director of Marketing Communications for the Madison Children's Museum. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Hello, thanks for having us.
And Dave Heide is founder of Little John's, the nonprofit Pay What You Can restaurant. He's also executive chef at Liliana's. Chef Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Good to be back.
Well, I think I talked to you a few years ago, and you're getting rolling with this Pay What You Can restaurant model. Can you talk about what motivated you to pursue that?
Yeah, I think a lot of people think of a restaurateur as someone who makes a lot of money and does well, but we definitely had our struggles throughout all of it, and our whole family had a lot of food insecurity throughout the owning of the restaurant. So, I think there's a, especially in Dane County where we are, I think there's a big kind of misconception that there isn't food insecurity because you don't see it everywhere, but there's actually a lot of food insecurity. The school that my youngest, John, goes to, 66% of the kids there are below the poverty line, with the majority of them experiencing food insecurity. So I think it was kind of to help get rid of that stigma of what food security looks like. And I think that's one of the reasons why the pairing works so well at the Children's Museum. You know, I know a lot of people see the Children's Museum and they see some families who have a lot of money and they're like, well, why would you go there? There are so many families in need. And I say, like, the Children's Museum is amazing because it's the same prospect that we go at, which is, you know, you can't tell what food insecurity looks like. It's the same thing with poverty. You can't tell what poverty looks like. So the Children's Museum has a ton of programs to help get people who don't have enough resources into the museum.
Jonathan, why was it important for the Madison Children's Museum to have this accessibility option, this pay what you can meal option?
Well, Chef Dave says we've been concerned about accessibility and sustainability, which is also a shared value, for a long time. And we have programs like $1 admission, $15 memberships, a free first-time parent membership. All those are part of our Access for Everyone program. And we know that we run lately between 25 and 30% of our visitors are using one of those programs. So absolutely, there's need. And you can't play on an empty stomach. You can't play and learn well. You know, our missions were so aligned that it just, and we needed a cafe, right? We had a cafe before the pandemic. We shut down. We hadn't figured out what kind of new cafe to have. So this was the perfect mission-based kind of cafe, whereas before we had kind of more of a revenue, goal with it. Now this is very mission-based.
And Chef Dave, talk us through, a parent comes in with their kids, they walk up to the restaurant. What do they see? What do they do?
A three-door cooler that's filled with meals that are made every single day. We drop off at the Children's Museum. And then there's a microwave bank there that they can heat them up. And then there's a terminal where they can pay what they can, or there's a drop box for them to drop cash if they don't want to pay with credit. And it really is pay what you can. So the idea of pay what you can is that those who have can maybe help contribute a little bit more to help sustain our meals and help sustain the museum. And then those who don't have can pay what they can. So whether that's $100, which I think we had a couple people already pay $100 for a cookie, which is fantastic, or whether it's a dollar or whether it's nothing. The reason we wanted to have the terminals is because there is a barrier to food access if you've got a human you've got to interact with. So we wanted to have it be as accessible for anyone and to not have anyone feel judged if they want to get a fresh made from scratch meal for their kid.
And Jonathan, this just opened up late last week, I believe. What's the response been so far?
Well, we also had a soft open for a little bit. There were a lot of new things to work out for this because there's no models to really look to. But the response has been great. I think one of my favorite comments was, we love the ease and the mac and cheese. But a lot of people have pointed out that they just love that we're doing this, either, you know, because they need it or they just are so happy that we're doing it on behalf of the community. Really, it's all been positive.
And Chef Dave, I know another part of this story is food waste. You don't like it. And sustainability, you do like that. How is that showing up at this Little John's Pay What You Can restaurant?
Oh, it's been great. So our mission at Little John's is we create access with excess. So, you know, Americans throw away 40% of all food produced in the United States, and that's pre-consumer. So we work with grocery stores to take amazing produce and ingredients, which, to be honest, are even better than some of the stuff I can get at Liliana's, even the excess, and cook it and turn it into chef-made meals. So it's been really great. And I think, I know that there's the perception, the first off when you hear food excess, you think food waste or food garbage. And that's the opposite of what we're getting. We're getting like amazing dairy, amazing produce, proteins, and the food tastes great. And if you don't believe me, come try a meal at the Children's Museum.
And Jonathan, as we wrap up, if somebody's listening and they run, maybe it's a museum or other institution and thinking, hey, this is something our community could use, what would you suggest to them on getting started?
They should probably talk to us because there weren't a lot of people to talk to. I mean, even the payment system, most of them are retail or their donations. And this sort of has to blend them both. We'd be happy to talk to people about it. But it's been going really well. And we really haven't had problems with it. And it's just had an excellent reception.
Jonathan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Chef Dave, good to talk to you. Hope we can get you on a Food Friday again sometime.
Anytime. Literally anytime. Love chatting with you guys.
We're talking to Dave Heide, chef and founder of the new Pay What You Can restaurant and nonprofit Little John's. He's also executive chef at the restaurant Liliana's. And Jonathan Zeroff, director of marketing communications for the Madison Children's Museum. They joined us to talk about the first Pay What You Can restaurant in a Wisconsin museum, possibly the first one in any museum in the country. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about embracing adventure and letting go.
You don't have to travel far to find adventure. Writer Jill Susan Quinn and her son recently spent an afternoon at a local park where he had a run-in with both stinging nettle and a fallen log, causing her to reflect on the lessons to be found in independence and letting go.
I take my son to Stedman Wayside Park in Portage County. I happened upon it once 15 years ago and haven't been there since. That was after I'd just moved to Wisconsin from a place and at an age where I measured hikes in tens of miles and thousands of feet in elevation gain. Stedman's trail-less 24 acres, with its single grill and picnic table, was a puzzle I was not equipped at the time to understand. Now the mother of a 7-year-old, my priorities have changed. As soon as he steps from the car, my son begins to forge a path downstream from the Tomorrow River's small waterfall, alternating between the riverbank's deep mud and lush foliage and the water's large rocks and fallen logs. I point out skunk cabbage and tear off a section of leaf for him to smell. He points out a tiny shoot of crystal clear water pouring from the steep hillside beneath a tree's raised roots. All of a sudden, I notice the underside of his forearm is covered with alarming red dots. My eye glides over to a jagged-leaved plant. "Stinging nettle!" I exclaim. He's seen it before, but this is his first time touching it. We kneel down and cover his arm in black mud from the river's bottom. I pick off a few stems of jewelweed and offer the plant's aloe-like salve, but he has already moved on. The forest becomes too thick, and he turns to make his way back upstream. I pull out my phone to take a photo. I watch as he slips on a mossy log over the water, grabs it with both hands and both feet, and rolls completely under, hanging like a baby chimpanzee beneath its mother's belly. The creek wets him from the collar of his T-shirt to the tops of his boots. "Let go," I say, and he does, rights himself, and wades out, flinging off water and laughing with joy at his soaked body. Back at the car, I suggest viewing the river from the road. We walk there, and he wants to go down to the water again. We descend beneath the road bridge to the piles of granite beneath. My son begins to launch the rocks into the river, seeming to enjoy this place and pastime even more than exploring the official park. Watching him, I remember how much time I spent as a child under bridges. Railroad bridges out of use, railroad bridges in use, road bridges. With my best friend, the neighbor boys, and my older sisters, I climbed over guardrails and jumped onto concrete pylons, followed their gentle declines, careful not to slip, to the riprap beneath, avoided snakes and poison ivy to cast my father's old fishing rod and plunge into deep, dark swimming holes. Once, my friend and I scientifically narrowed down from a patch of weeds near a particular bridge just which plant was making us itch. Our first time, like my son today, with stinging nettle. We touched it repeatedly, laughing gleefully at the plant's fierce but short-lived war against our skin. This, I think, is what my son needs more than anything. Not a hike with his plant-identifying mother on a recognized trail with a destination, but a bike, a friend, and bridges to climb under. He needs a rushing creek to receive his skipped stones, baited hooks, and half-clothed body. The adult world just a rumble above as cars pass to and fro toward unnecessary destinations, their hum an untranslatable language, like the mumbling of the parents in the classic Peanuts cartoon. And what I need is to be fearless and non-critical, to stop ignoring the waysides, to let my son's world expand to wherever he wishes, to as close or as far as he can pedal without me, to as high or as low as he wants to climb, to as large or as small and as secret a place as he can find.
Jill Sisson Quinn is an author who teaches writing at Mid-State Technical College and lives in Scandinavia, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Buy more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit, the highest percent of Americans ever recorded, 53% explored outdoor spaces like parks and wildlife centers. That's according to the Outdoor Industry Association. But enjoying those outdoor spaces can still be a challenge for a lot of people, including some people with physical disabilities. There might be better access to outdoor wheelchairs in some places or accessible restrooms, but there's still a long way to go before everyone's able to access outdoor spaces. Monica Spaney is founder and president of Access Ability Wisconsin. She's an environmental advocate and recently was awarded the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation Conservationist of the Year in 2022. Monica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
When we talk about creating better accessibility in the outdoors here in Wisconsin, what are some of the first things that come to your mind?
Well, I'll tell you what doesn't come to my mind is paving nature and putting down, you know, paved trails. But what comes to mind is adaptive equipment like outdoor wheelchairs that can navigate through that more natural space.
Yeah, you shared a video with one of these outdoor wheelchairs. This was new to me. Can you talk about this and describe it a little? It's not your everyday wheelchair you're going to see.
Correct. This is a wheelchair that has like tank-like tracks, but it goes walking speed. And the advantage of it is that it tilts. So if you're going up a hill, you can tilt to be level. Or if you're going down a hill, you can tilt to be level. It has five speeds. And so if you're going through over a log, you can slowly go over the log at a slower speed. And then if the trail is nice and mowed, you can walk with your family and social connections where you're participating actively together.
What was it like for you the first time you took one of these for a spin and went out on a trail that previously would not have been an option for you?
It was wow. because I was with my husband at the time, and he was like, you should follow the ATV, because they were going through the corn stalks and everything. And I'm like, I ain't going where the ATV is going. I'm going where I want to go. And so it was a relief to him, because he didn't have to worry about the burden of me falling out of my mobility device. I just happen to be a wheelchair user, but it could be a walker, it could be a cane, it could be somebody with COPD. So he wasn't worried. He was with me. We could hold hands, and I could actively participate and watch the birds or the deer or the pheasants. It was awesome, Rob.
How available are these, I guess, all-terrain wheelchairs in natural areas at this point?
They're not very readily available in Wisconsin. We started AAW, Accessibility Wisconsin, in 2014 and got our very first wheelchair so that people could use. The problem is the cost. These outdoor wheelchairs cost over, with the enclosed trailer, over $25,000. Now, if you're an individual with some kind of mobility issue, you tend to need an accessible restroom or doors to go through or an accessible vehicle, and all of that costs extra. You're looking at a good $50,000 or more. It could be even $150,000. So now take the cost of these hiking boots for people with mobility challenges. They're $25,000. Would you pay $25,000 for hiking boots that then you have to take to a location with a truck or something that can tow a trailer to be able to do that?
Probably not. So I understand you at Accessibility Wisconsin are working with nature centers and other places. What kind of what have you seen so far? Who's participating in this so far?
Sure. We actually have three nature centers that are our host locations. So they host the chair and trailer there. People can check the chair and trailer out and take it to a location, or they can use it on location if they don't have the ability to tow. And we have won awards for coming up with this model. It's a new type of model.
Are you hoping it's going to spread now to more nature centers and conservation areas?
Yes, we have. We're a nature center in Milwaukee, and we have Ozaukee County River Edge Nature Center. We have Beaver Creek and Eau Claire, and we're continuing to work with other nature centers. So if you know of a nature center that we should work with, let us know. It's advantageous to partner so that their nature center is more accessible and people are able to get out and have healthy living and participate in the programming just like everyone else.
Talking to Monica Spaney, founder and president of Accessibility Wisconsin. She won the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation Conservationist of the Year in 2022, looking at accessibility in natural areas in Wisconsin. Monica, apart from these all-terrain nature wheelchairs, I guess tread chairs, really, they're not wheels, what other efforts are you focusing on this year?
Well, we're always focusing on partnering with organizations, because our goal is to get one chair and trailer in every county. And right now we have 24. So we get that funding with grants and matching memorial donations or general donations. So we work hard to get more chairs and more trailers so that people can use them all across Wisconsin. We want people to be able to visit and see those nature centers and participate. And then it also increases a positive outlook for our Wisconsin residents and decreases depression. So it's equity, healthy living, inclusion, and access.
So I want to get your message to a few different groups here. First of all, if somebody is involved in managing a natural area and wants, this is, hey, this would be cool, where do they start? How do they start getting involved in this?
Go to our website, accessibilitywi.org. Click on hosting. We have a whole bunch of hosting opportunities.
And then for people who think, yeah, I want to do this, I haven't been able to hike on a trail in a long time, how can they keep track of where they can go and find these things?
Yes, if you go out to our website, we have a map page that shows the AAW network and the counties that we serve. So you could check it out at a location, close to you, or if you're going to visit a location, you could check it up at the location that you're visiting.
And then if I imagine if there are people out there who want to support the effort, your website would probably be a good start, but can people help out and contribute to being able to provide these things in natural areas?
Yes, we have a donation page and people can donate. As I said, there are a variety of ways of donating their time. So please get involved. Donating their money, or down the road if they want to do a memorial fund. So we're looking at it from all directions, sir.
And can you tell us more about the technology itself? Are we seeing advancements in these kind of accessible wheelchairs that can go more and cooler places and be more convenient for their users?
Yes, there are advances both in accessories. There are advances. We're looking at how the tilt can, the product is built in Minnesota. So they're looking at how the tilt can be more automatic. There's an attendant control for people who can't control a joystick. There's seatbelt extenders, different size chairs. And we also have a standing chair. If I answered your question correctly.
Sure. And can you talk about more about who you're working with? I understand, among others, disability organizations, the parks themselves, and veterans groups. Can you talk about the coalition you're bringing together to try to make this a reality?
Yes. Our objective is to partner not only with senior centers. We're also working on Marathon County, trying to get the Hmong community and the tribal communities involved. We are working in Milwaukee to try to get more access in the urban area, seeing what we can do. So our partners have included everything from sportsmen's clubs to nature centers. And we've also worked with the Madison Audubon Society to make their events more accessible, the Wisconsin Natural Resources Foundation to make their field trips accessible. And we're always working with the DNR to help make both the state parks and their events accessible.
Monica, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this with us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob, and I look forward to talking about other opportunities.
That's Monica Spaney, founder and president of Accessibility Wisconsin. Monica joined us today to talk about outdoor accessibility, what it looks like here in Wisconsin, and an effort to increase that accessibility around the state.